Discovery is not the privilege of professionals alone. You're listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Hello and welcome back for another conversation here on Western Worlds, an AFM original show heard right here on astronomy.fm. My name is Raymond Francis and I'm coming to you this week, as every week, from the Centre for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University in London, Ontario, Canada. The naked eye planets, Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn, were known from antiquity and gave no clue there were others like them. When Hipparchus produced a catalogue of visible stars, the whole of the universe seemed visible, and its bodies countable, if numerous. Once Galileo turned a telescope on the skies, however, he found new discoveries everywhere he looked, seeing the moons of Jupiter, the phases of Venus, and many other phenomena for the first time ever. The subsequent history of astronomy appears, at first glance, to be a story of new and more distant discoveries made with ever better and more powerful instruments, each making their predecessor obsolete. In modern times, the study of the universe seems limited to those with access to vast resources: orbital telescopes, remote mountaintop observatories, or radio telescopes with distributed apertures measuring a square kilometer. But even our own solar system hasn't yet been fully explored. New asteroids are continually being found, for example, and occasionally new comets come into view. These cold, icy little worlds remain poorly understood, even after spacecraft have visited a few to inspect them closely. Each chance to observe a comet's passage through the inner solar system is an opportunity to better study their behavior, nature, and origin. Most remarkably, these objects are sometimes discovered by amateur astronomers using backyard-scale equipment matched with dedication and hours of perseverance and care. Don Machholz is one of these comet hunters. Since the mid-1970s, he has dedicated thousands of hours to systematic searches for comets, with 11 discovered so far. His work has led him to develop his own observational techniques, build his own telescopes, and write several books. Western World's Parshati Patel spoke with him at the Starfest public astronomy event near Mount Forest, Ontario.
Thank you very much for talking to us today. Let me start off by asking, first of all, how did you think about looking for comets? Because it's not normal, you know, looking for planets or something like that. So how did that come about?
Well, I got involved in astronomy, got interested in astronomy at the age of 8 or 9, and began with meteors and shooting stars, got my first telescope at the age of 13, got my 6-inch reflector when I was 16, and I observed all the Massey objects. I really enjoy visual observing. I also did some astrophotography, but not much. When I came out of the U.S. military in 1974, I wanted to find a project that would keep me looking through the telescope because I enjoy the view of the night sky. And there were probably 3 areas I could have gone into. One was variable star observing. Very worthwhile project. You can produce some useful information, and it definitely keeps you looking through the telescope. Another would be tracking asteroids and measuring the brightness variations for rotational measurements. And that was kind of a new field. Didn't really know if I wanted to do that, and most of the asteroids were fairly faint. The third project I examined was searching for new comets. I had seen comets before. I knew that amateurs would sometimes discover them. And so I began to research that. And I saw that took maybe on the average about 300 hours of searching to find a comet. After practicing for a few months and just kind of seeing if I enjoyed it, I decided to start a systematic search. And I believed it to be a win-win situation. I would give it a try, spend months out there searching for comets. If I didn't find any comet, I still spent a lot of time looking through the telescope, which is what I enjoy. So I began on January 1st, 1975, a systematic search for comets.
Okay, and until now you have discovered 11, right?
11 comets, yes.
Yeah. So tell me about the first comet. Like, how was it? You know, obviously it's your first comet that you discovered. How did it come about? What kind of resources did you need? What kind of amount of hours you had to put in to actually discover the first one?
Well, the first comet took quite a while to discover. I had thought maybe 300 hours. My first year was 307 hours. My second year, 553 hours. My third year, 504 hours. And still no comet discovered. Other people were finding comets. I wasn't. I would miss them for one reason or another. But I would be out there about 200 nights a year, most of the time in the morning searching for comets. And I began with a 4 1/4 inch reflector. Within the first year of comet hunting, I bought a 10-inch telescope mirror, built a telescope around it, and so I was using that. Picking up a lot of galaxies and clusters, just having a good time, scanning the sky systematically, mostly in the mornings. So on the morning of September 12, 1978, I was sweeping an area of the sky in the morning just south of the star Sirius, and I picked up a fuzzy object about 2 degrees south of the star, and I knew there was no galaxy or cluster that would be 11th magnitude in that area. So I was pretty sure it was a comet, but I had to check for motion. Normally, a comet will appear to move against the background stars in about a half an hour's time. You can notice some movement. It's not very fast, usually, but enough you can notice it. So I made my drawing, but it was around the time of astronomical twilight. So before I could detect any motion, the sky brightened up so much I could not see it. I went home, showered, got dressed, went to work, and I thought, well, I think I should probably report this. I don't have any motion, but what else can it be? So when I got home from work that night, I went and sent a telegram to the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory. They are the clearinghouse for comet discoveries. And I reported that I believed I had a comet, that I did not see any motion, and I would check it the next morning. Next morning, I went out there, and lo and behold, the object had moved about 2 degrees, 1 degree south of where it was. And so it was, in fact, a comet moving south. And I went back home and notified the Smithsonian once again, hey, this thing has moved. And at that point, after you report a comet, it's left up to the Smithsonian to handle it. They will get other people out there to confirm it because they just can't take my word for it. And in this case, the European Southern Observatory had a 1 meter telescope, and they were able to image it, and that thereby confirmed the comet discovery. They also determined the orbit. They also determined the name that goes on it, and so on. So that was my first comet discovery. That comet was visible for only about 30 days. It then headed too far south for me to see. It was growing dimmer. It never got closer than the Earth in its orbit around the sun. And when I discovered it, it was already on its way back out of the solar system. I decided to keep searching for comets. By then, it was a habit. It was integrated into my daily life, so it was a fairly easy thing to get up at 2 o'clock in the morning and drive for 40 minutes and set up your telescope and search for comets. And I kept doing that, but it was going to be not until 1985, some 8 years later, that I discovered my second. And that one took even longer. The first one took 1,700 hours exactly. The second one, 1,746 hours. And so that one I discovered at the Riverside Telescope Makers Conference. And it went too close to the sun and it disintegrated.
Oh.
So it was only visible again for about a month.
Wait, still discovering.
Yeah.
How different is it to discover something else compared to a comet? Because if it's probably away from the sun, it's really hard to see. When obviously when it comes near the sun, you see a spectacular view of it. But how hard was it in terms of the 11 discoveries to discover these dark objects away from the sun?
Well, as a comet gets close, comet's like a dirty snowball, and no two are alike. Some are very fluffy, they disintegrate easily. Some are held together very well. And as a comet nears the sun, material mainly ices, sublime and turn from a solid into a gas. That forms the coma. That's illuminated by the sun, and that's why we can see them. So when a comet is first picked up in a telescope, it normally looks like a faint galaxy or even a globular cluster, which is not resolved. That's the first sign that you have a comet. Usually you do not see a tail at the time of discovery, because if we find them early enough, the tails haven't developed yet. They usually don't develop until it gets within the orbit of Mars. So most of the comets that I have found have been between 9th and 11th magnitude. And most of the time when I'm sweeping the sky and I pick up that unfamiliar fuzzy object, I know in an instant, this should not be here. This is not a galaxy and it's not a cluster. But then you have to spend the next 10 minutes, next half hour, next hour proving that to yourself and securing some type of coordinates, the right ascension, declination. You have to make your map rather early, a hand-drawn map, and I'm not real good at drawing. And you have to check to see if it moves against the background stars. That's kind of critical. Because the Smithsonian really doesn't wish to pursue comet discoveries unless there's some motion involved.
Because they are dark objects, how close they are, I would say, to being an asteroid, because they are dark objects too. Maybe, you know, sometimes it's an asteroid, and how different they are in terms of discovering an asteroid and discovering a comet.
An asteroid will look like a star-like object through a telescope. A comet, one that's active, will appear to be extended. Not a point source, but at least an arc minute in size. And most of the ones that I find are 2, 3, 4 arc minutes in size and somewhat diffuse. In the scientific community, there continues to be the question of the difference between an asteroid and a comet. Generally speaking, asteroids have more of a circular orbit. They're usually within the plane of the solar system. On the other hand, we find some comets that do that. And we find some asteroids that have some awkward orbits too. As for composition and behavior, sometimes have an object discovered these days which appears to be an asteroid through the imaging that discovers them. And then other astronomers follow up with other scopes and they stack some images and they see it even better. And they notice, oh, it has a coma on it. So now something that originally was thought to be an asteroid is in fact a comet because it's outgassing. It has to do something with the composition of it and the surface composition, the material on the top. If it's subliming and forming a coma, then pretty much by definition it's a comet. And if it's not, it's probably not a comet. Although we do have some inactive comets, which might be active on one passage, but not so much on the other.
So there's a fine line.
There's a fine line.
You also do the comet hunting program. What is that, and is there any way, you know, if someone is interested in hunting for comets, what kind of advice would you give them?
Well, nowadays there's not too many visual comet discoverers. I continue to search visually, have for 7,900 hours since 1975, and I probably will continue to do that. There's probably fewer than a dozen amateur astronomers around the world who visually search. Some of those who used to visually search have moved up to using CCD cameras, even still photographic films, and they can better cover the sky by seeing deeper, by seeing fainter objects, by picking up a comet before it becomes bright enough for someone like me to see it. At the same time, we're competing against some major programs done by various governments and organizations that wish to find asteroids and comets that might one day hit us. Those programs are scattered throughout the world in both hemispheres now. And they tend to pick up the comets before we find them. Once again, they can see fainter than we can, so they pick them up before we would normally pick them up. And so in the 1970s and the 1980s, amateur astronomers were visually finding very consistently about 3.3 comets per year. And in the last 5 years or so, we find about one comet every 3 years visually. It's rare to do that. There are still comets that get through the network provided by the governments and their searches. Comets can still do that, and we hope as visual comet discoverers to be able to pick up some of those still. Someone who wishes to discover a comet would probably be best suited using a wide-field instrument with a CCD covering the morning sky near the horizon, and the comets that they would have to find would probably be 12th, 13th magnitude. And they would be before they would move into the areas scanned by the big governments. The other way is to go online and look up the SOHO images. Many people do this. And learn how to spot those tiny SOHO comets as they move in toward the sun. SOHO images are provided free, almost in real time. And there are people who, sitting at their computers, they don't have to go out and look at the sun or look at the sky. They detect on those images SOHO comets. And you can communicate with the director, let him know what you see, do some follow-up for motion. You have to see two or three images to make sure that it's not just a defect in the camera or a cosmic ray hit in the camera. And you can discover a comet that way. Now, your name is not attached to it because they used SOHO equipment to discover it. The comet is given the designation SOHO with a number behind it. Now they're up to 2,000 or something. But that is another way, in fact, to discover a comet. Most of the SOHO comets do not last very long. From the time they discover, they're discovered, they're usually within a few hours of disintegrating as they get very close to the sun.
So I would quickly want to ask you, you are also part of the team that developed the Messier Marathon. So what was the idea behind that, and how has it changed the idea of people who are especially amateurs to getting into astronomy or getting into amateur astronomy or observational astronomy?
The Messier Marathon was an idea that I came up with in late 1978. A few others had too. I put together an observing list based upon the order in which things set or move across the sky or convenience. And I helped to publicize it in the 80s and 90s and throughout. I've written a couple books on the Messier Marathon. But the Messier Marathon is an attempt to view as many of the Messier objects as you can in one night. Messier objects are the brightest 110 galaxies, clusters, and nebula observable from the northern hemisphere. And it is possible in late March to see all of them in one night. You don't need to see all of them, but people do try to see what they can do. It's a good test of, it's a good practice to refine your skills at finding things through the telescope. Now, back in the 70s and 80s, people who wanted to do this had to either use manual setting circles to find the objects or use star maps and star hop. And a lot of us still will do that today. But in the last 15 years or so, people have developed Go-To telescopes, which will help you find these automatically. And they still have a part of the Messier Marathon, too. We don't want to exclude anyone from going out and observing. It helps them become better able to use their Go-To telescopes when you find 100 objects in one night using it. And finding the Messier objects over the last few decades has become a greater part of amateur astronomy, due in part to the Messier Marathon. There are astronomy clubs all around the world now that hold Messier Marathons in late March, and people get together and they just see what they can do. It's not that hard. There's no penalty if you lose, and you can have a good time. And in the course of one night, from dusk to dawn, you can see 100 galaxies, clusters, and nebulae, and find them yourself. That's pretty amazing. And people do that.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. I haven't done it, but I should really try. Yeah. But what's your expectation for Comet Issen?
Comet Issen, we know what the geometry is. We know what part of the sky it will be in, when it will be behind the sun, as seen from the Earth. And all of that is fixed. We can't do anything about that. That can be predicted very well. Question is, how's it going to behave as far as the, actually all three parts of the comet, the nucleus, the coma, and the tail. How's the nucleus going to be? Well, this comet does go very close to the sun. If it behaves like a normal comet, it will brighten up extremely well. That doesn't mean it will be easily visible, because when it's at its brightest, it will be close to the sun. Is it going to survive? Nobody knows. Even a comet nucleus that breaks up can put on a good show, as Comet West did in 1976. It broke into four parts, and after it went around the sun, it was in the morning sky, a beautiful comet. So just because it breaks up doesn't mean it's going to fail. Doesn't mean it will succeed if it breaks up, neither. Or if it evaporates as a loosely packed snowball might, then we would probably not have a very good show. As far as the coma and the brightness, again, it will be at its brightest when it's kind of close to the sun. That means it will be best observable in the daytime. But in the daytime, the sun's up, which makes it hard to see. As the comet rounds the sun and enters the morning sky, might we then get a pretty good view. And perhaps the most striking thing of the comet will be the tail. Comets that go close to the sun generally have very long tails, but you'll need a dark sky in which to see it. So I have no predictions. We would like to have a good show with the comet. If not, there will be others that will be by. In later years, that will put on good shows. This is not the last comet to come around, but it should be an interesting show in any case. And the key to seeing it well is to have a good eastern horizon, especially southeastern horizon, to have good dark skies, and to have clear skies in December. And that's not always an easy combination to get.
All right, thank you so much for talking to us today.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Let's go to the discussion.
We just listened to my interview with Don Michaels, and he has the record of second highest number of comet discoveries. And I found it very, very interesting that he's an amateur astronomer and hunts comets.
Yeah, this is one of those cases where you're still, with amateur-level equipment and amateur-level commitment, able to actually go and discover new things.
But I mean, still, like, if you look at the number of hours he committed over last whatever
hundreds
number of years,
thousands, yeah.
thousands of hours,
yeah.
I mean, given that you have a job mm-hmm. to do, and then this is kind of your hobby.
Yeah.
And we didn't talk about much about this in the interview, but I went to his talk and he had pictures. He built up a big observatory.
Oh, yes?
To actually put in his telescope there and actually discover this comet. So initially he was just using, you know, a telescope in his backyard, and then he's built a big observatory for it. And
okay.
It was so cool to see that, you know, this passion of finding comets actually drove him to invest his time, money, and come up with so many discoveries.
Yeah, and it's a lot of diligent work, as you see, you know, hundreds and thousands of hours over several years. But he's managed to make it work, and you know, it's an example of, with that level of dedication, you can certainly find the new things that people haven't seen before, and I'm sure that's a thrill.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think now that we have so many spacecrafts and data sets that basically mm-hmm. we don't even need our own equipment to go look for these comets. You basically download these data sets, freely available data sets, and sit in front of a computer, which I'm assuming everyone has one,
yeah.
and basically go through all the pictures and the data and find new comets.
Yeah, and this is of course, the other way to do it through these things. And there are a bunch of these kind of citizen science mm-hmm. projects where people can contribute to real science. But there's a lot of things now, you know, exoplanets, for example, are something
yeah.
that you can't discover in your backyard with a telescope,
yeah.
right? And then, you know, there are a lot of applications that really you science has been driven to very, very large, very expensive instruments.
Mm-hmm.
But a guy with a telescope in his backyard is still able to find comets sometimes.
Yeah.
And that's pretty neat.
Yeah, and it's not just comets. So mm-hmm. there are also, for example, when I did my master's project, we actually mm-hmm. used data collected by an amateur astronomer about a variable star.
Oh.
So it's not just comets. There are all other different kinds of areas where people could go into, even though they're not actually, you know, don't have a degree in science. It doesn't matter if you have interest, if you have resources, and if you have time, you mm-hmm. can do them.
One of the things that I also find kind of amusing is that so the same people who are looking for comets are now doing the Messier marathons.
Yeah.
Because my understanding is that Messier made that catalog of galaxies and things specifically because he was looking for comets and he wanted a list of things that were not comets.
Yeah.
So that he wouldn't get confused with them.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so here they are. Now they're already a sort of a form of astronomical tourism to go look at the Messier objects, which to themselves are not comets.
Yeah. And I think it's a very interesting way. So he was a part of the team that developed this Messier marathon. And mm-hmm. I think it's a very nice way of getting, you know, general public to get involved, and it doesn't need a lot of resources.
Mm-hmm.
And as he said, astronomy clubs around the world are doing this and getting so many kids interested in sciences and have them, you know, go on to make maybe an astronomer or a planetary scientist just by going through this once a process of trying to find all these major objects.
Yeah, and it's a good exercise of learning how to point a telescope mm-hmm. and also finding objects that, you know, many of them are not really very visible with the naked eye,
mm-hmm.
But are quite visible with a reasonable sized telescope, in backyard scale telescopes. Mm-hmm. And among all the things you might look at the sky, they're some of the most interesting.
Yeah.
And you can see enough detail that you know, they're very distinctive objects. So it's an interesting set of things to look at, which is cool. It makes a good set for people who are just getting into it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would also like to make a point I get this a lot when I go to classrooms or in general, just talking to public of, you know, mm-hmm. I'm an astronomer, I do this. And immediately what they think is, oh, so we look at stars through telescope all the time. Mm-hmm. And that is actually not true.
Mm-hmm, of course.
Real astronomers or planetary scientists aren't looking at stars and planets all the time.
Yeah.
Basically, mm-hmm. 99% of their time is spent on computers, getting the data from the telescopes, sitting in front of their computer, and actually processing the data to understand what the science is behind. Most of the time is spent by the amateur astronomers in using the telescope and looking at their objects.
Yeah, these are the people who still have their eye up to the telescope. Yeah,
yeah, and this interview was actually taken at one of the star parties that I went, and this was my first time.
Right.
And I could not believe how many people own a huge telescope. All of them are amateur astronomers.
Mm-hmm.
Huge telescope. They spend literally hours every week looking at the sky, different mm-hmm. objects. And me, being an astronomer, I don't spend that much time looking at the stars through the telescope.
Yeah.
So it is very interesting to see a lot of people are taking up this as an amateur, as a hobby,
yep.
and then getting so much out of it, not just, you know, looking at the stars or looking at the galaxies. They get science out of it, even by just using a backyard telescope.
Yeah, and I've been to a few places in Canada where there are sort of amateur astronomer groups and clubs and associations that have fairly impressive sort of permanent observatories that they've mm-hmm. built in some dark place.
Yeah.
And actually they can spend whatever clear nights they have looking through telescopes at things. And as you say, those of us who actually work in space science, we're looking at data sets of spectrographs and whatever
yeah.
coming from large instruments, looking at them on computers.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's interesting that it's the amateur community who actually probably are looking at the sky directly more.
Yeah. Yeah, I always get this question of they think that because, like, even in my friends, because they think I'm an astronomer,
mm-hmm.
I easily know how to point at a telescope, they would give it to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I would know everything and anything about telescopes and where the constellations are, which object is what. But truly, when I talk to these amateur astronomers, I probably know the least about the sky than they know. Because they are so, you know, into it. They do this all the time.
Yeah.
And me, even though I have data sets, but I don't look at the sky as often as they do.
Yeah, and maybe this is a good exercise for people who are kind of graduate or professional
mm-hmm.
sort
yeah.
of astronomers to occasionally spend some time in that
yeah.
community. Because that's something that you know, if every sailor should know how to tie a few
yeah.
knots, maybe
yeah.
every astronomer should know how to point a telescope.
I think my main agenda for going to the star party was that.
Mm-hmm.
That I really, because I do a lot of outreach and I like to, you know, go out and talk to kids about it.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing they probably ask is about night sky. And even though, like, I've learned over the years of all the outreach work I do, it's still amazing to see how amateur astronomers know so much about it. And it's so much, you get to learn so much from them.
Mm-hmm.
That's our show for this week. Western Worlds is a co-production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration and Astronomy.fm. Western Worlds was created by John Moores. This episode was produced by Parshati Patel and Michael Forster, and featured an interview by co-host Parshati Patel. Our roundtable discussion featured co-hosts Raymond Francis and Parshati Patel. Our editors were Michael Forster and Parshati Patel, and I'm Raymond Francis. Our theme music is Heliosheath by Sean Kim. You can continue the conversation online and listen to past episodes or learn more about Western Worlds by visiting our website at cpsx.uwo.ca/westernworlds. You can also email us at westernworlds@uwo.ca. On Twitter, we are @WWAFM, and on Facebook, we are at facebook.com/westernworlds. On behalf of everyone here at Western Worlds, I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight. I hope you can make world enough in time to join us again next week, right here on astronomy.fm.